This is the fourth day of this March 2016 seven-day session, and we'll return to our text of the teachings of Kusan Sunim, 20th century teacher in Korea, reading from the book The Way of Korean Zen. This chapter is called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. I venture to ask the assembly, all of you, endowed with a pure, undefiled, original nature, have you completely awakened to it or not? If by chance you have penetrated the profound meaning of the patriarchs, then say something. You may know the unchanging nature by seeing bamboos and pines in the snow. Do you understand? And then he presents a verse. With the cessation of defilements, there is no high or low place. The pure original face cannot be assailed. In ice, flames appear. The bright light is all pervasive. The subtle Dharma, limitless as the sands along the Ganges, adorns the entire world. And then he continues, although many rivers converge in the sea, in the end their taste is one, and the flow of their waters comes to an end. Likewise, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Due to this, we suffer beneath the wheel of birth and death. But when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, the high and the low disappear. Common and accomplished beings vanish. Originally, all is equal. Therefore, the pure original face cannot be assailed. Originally, all is equal. The enlightened and the unenlightened completely vanish. He's speaking, of course, from the perspective of the absolute or the undifferentiated, the equality aspect of our nature. And there's the other side, the differentiation side, where we are, each one of us is in a different place in our practice, in our life, in our evolution to some small degree, although anyone who makes it to a sesshin is, I venture to say, pretty evolved to be able to choose to spend a week in these conditions and to get through them. Then he strikes his staff. The pure original nature that is able to hear this sound and see this staff cannot be assailed. It does not undergo the suffering of birth and death. It is not stained by defilements. So there is within every one of us equally this flawless, luminous self-nature. And our job and practice is to realize that, to actualize that. Another Zen teacher once said, there's a Buddha in your belly. There's a blind Buddha in your belly. Make him see. All the affairs of the world are just like dreams. With a single stroke of a knife, completely sever all concerns. Only search for awakening. Not only must you discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, but the Buddhas as well. You must finish with it all. He's talking about, in order to reach this this insight, at that moment there cannot be any of these things in the mind. He's really talking about what it takes to have a completely pure, that is, empty mind. Doesn't mean that we have to somehow delete all of our learning in our life. Just means in order to break through this discriminating consciousness, at least for a moment, there can be no trace of conceptualization in the mind. Certainly not any ideas about fame or wealth or glory, not even comfort, cleverness. Comfort. I think in the course of Zen's brief history in the West, or certainly in this country, we've seen this shift of expectation as to the comfort we should have in practicing. In sitting with pain, some pain, let's call it discomfort, some pain can really help get more concentrated. I think a lot of people find that with some degree of pain, they can reach deeper states of concentration. It really is a way, it's like a lever, the pain in the body to become more concentrated. If the pain were to continue to increase, then there comes a point when it's distracting, when it becomes a preoccupation. It's a negotiable point, this optimal level of pain. Some, but not too much. But it seems that over these last 20 or 30 years, that more people are ready to find ways to escape the pain rather than use it. This is all an individual thing, of course. Each person has to work that out for herself or himself. But there comes a point when we're not doing ourselves any favor by avoiding a more painful posture. We're really really giving up the possibility of using pain to break through to a deeper level of absorption in our practice. I can't help but think that this is a reflection of the wider shift in our culture of avoiding pain at any cost, and even ultimately the addiction to opioids and other things to avoid pain. I just throw this out because I don't want to see anyone giving up the opportunity to skillfully use some discomfort, some physical discomfort, to go beyond themselves. That's what we're talking about. How can we get beyond, really, how can we get out beyond our comfort zone, out of our comfort zone? As long as we cling to our comfort zone, then we're not likely to discover new realms. He goes on, an ancient master once said, the bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. And that's the end of the quote. And Kusan continues, this bright spiritual light, which is able to hear this sound and see this staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become a sentient being. Not once has it become a Buddha. In other words, it is beyond change. For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant. Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. He's probably referring to the monastery door. After practicing for a while, you may come to think that you know something. Then you start conceptualizing. For example, if you have been meditating on mu, you may think, that which says mu, isn't that it? Those working on the koan, what is this, may think, that which says, what is this, is that not it? This approach is wrong. Therefore, avoid speculative thinking. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. To practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. You will never achieve anything in that way. You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. Knowledge and conceptualization are not appropriate. Yeah, we all can hear this and say, right, we know that, you know, we're doing Zazen, and conceptualizing is not what we should be doing. But how many people are really ready to let go of their thoughts and concepts while sitting? This pairing of birth and death, I think maybe it's not the most meaningful to a lot of us. Birth and death, the suffering of death. All right, fair enough. But birth, I think it's not something that most of us relate to much. It really points to this. The suffering of the human condition, of the whole round of being born, and then over the course of one's life, whether it's short or long, enduring various kinds of suffering, physical suffering, emotional suffering, losses, crises, anxiety, frustration, and then ultimately one's own death, dying. And then starting all over again. I think it's easier for those of us Westerners to just understand the fear of death and dying. Actually, they're not quite the same. I guess I've read that they've done surveys and a lot of people who say, no, I'm not afraid of death, will acknowledge that they're afraid of how they're going to die. They're afraid of the process of dying. That's This is really what brings us here, isn't it, to something like Sesshin. And death never just means what we ordinarily think of as death, the death of the physical body at age 70 or 80 or 90, but really we're dying all the time. Some of the most painful death, the most painful kind of dying, is what we face in our daily lives. Humiliations, failures. This is really, really deaths. Dying to our protected sense of who we are. Sometimes that can make it easier to relate to fear of dying. People on social media, especially I'm thinking of teenagers, young people, get this all the time of having to face insults and humiliations. They're really facing, they're training in dying. And unfortunately, they're all too often not equipped, not ready to let go. This first line, you must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. Sincerity, I think in terms of practice, sincerity means to be fully into it and not sort of going through the motions. In other words, to be practicing with an undivided mind, to be practicing wholly. And not giving the appearance of doing this or that. For example, in doing yaza, late night sitting, it's, I think, fairly common that people want to put in some time in the zendo, maybe partly to make a good show to other people, to the teacher maybe, but also just feeling that they ought to be doing it. But sincerely would mean to really be doing it, really not just be putting in time, but be really engaged with the practice while sitting. And this can apply to practice outside the zendo as well. When you investigate the koan and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long. Remember, Kusan grew up on a farm. If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. How do they know to do that? It is the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whether you are investigating what is this, mu, or the cypress in the courtyard, the practice will not mature if you just hold the koan motionless. If you just watch it repeating, what is this, what is this, then you would be like a hen trying to hatch her eggs without moving them. This would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this manner. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around. So questioning is one way to move the eggs around. But as we were saying yesterday, not everyone finds that the question, they're really engaged with it as a question, in which case then you have to find another way to keep it lively, just through sheer concentration. When you notice that you're sitting with your mind just dwelling in thoughts, then, or that you're not fully engaged with the koan, or with the breath, doesn't matter, then you have to find a way to get more into it. How do you do that? Well, you find a way. It needs to be an active engagement with it. It needs to have vitality in it, and not be static. And that's not always easy. Sometimes you feel helpless. How do I do it? How do I get more deeply involved with the practice? You find a way. If you want to badly enough, you will find a way. You'll find a way. Just if you get desperate enough, you'll find a way. If you get fed up with just coasting along on the surface of the practice, you'll find a way. No one needs to be told, explained how to do this. A lot of it does just come out of need. When the need is strong enough, you'll find a way. He says, sitting still, merely keeping the koan in mind, is not correct practice. It is just like, quote, watching the tree waiting for the rabbit. Now, this is an allusion that we pick up later in the book. I'll read it now. There was once a man who was walking through the woods. A rabbit scurried by, ran headfirst into a tree, and killed itself. The man then took it home and ate it. He then thought that the tree must be a special rabbit-catching tree. So he started to come back to see if there were any more dead rabbits. But no matter how long he waited, what probability would there be of another rabbit dying there? Similarly, if you just sit, keeping the koan with neither continuity nor inquiry, no progress will be made in meditation. Here's another analogy he comes up with. You must also be like a cat trying to catch a mouse. Watch the look of a cat that is trying to catch a mouse at the foot of a stone wall. While slinking along at the base of the wall, it keeps its eyes firmly fixed on the hole where the mouse entered. At a place far away from the hole, it then sits silently in hiding. Its eyes continue to stare piercingly at the hole while waiting for the mouse to come out. At such a time, even if a person, a chicken or a dog, goes near the cat, it takes no notice of their passing and continues to watch the mouse hole. If the mouse appears for even an instant, like a flash of lightning, it leaps and grabs it. If even a cat proceeds so mindfully when trying to catch a mouse, how much more so should a person pursue awakening when practicing meditation? Cat, of course, doesn't have to contend with the conceptualizing mind. Furthermore, you must practice with a feeling of urgency, as though you were trying to extinguish a fire burning on your head. In such a situation, would you stop to ponder, is this heat due to fire? Is it really burning or not? Is there anybody present here who would experiment and let the fire burn for a while to see how well it burns? Under such circumstances, without thinking, you would immediately brush your hand over your head in order to get rid of the fire. You should cultivate meditation with the same sense of urgency. Well, to be fair, a lot of people just don't have that sense of urgency. And especially early in practice or even later in practice, there is a need, a strong enough need to sit every day, to come to Sesshin, but there isn't the sense of urgency. And there's not much that can be done about that, except for one important thing: keep sitting. Keep sitting. Keep coming to Sesshin, keep up with daily sitting, and our denial of the certainty of our death and the uncertainty of the time of death, it's harder to deny that, to keep that at bay, that awareness of our ultimate death. That's one way, maybe the best way. And then the rest is up to the world of change. As this person or that person in our life contracts a serious illness or is seriously injured or dies, then it starts to the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death starts to grow. Our awareness of it grows. It's harder to deny. He continues, "To live long would be to live for 100 years. A short life is over in the time it takes to inhale and exhale a single breath. 100 years of life depends upon a single breath, for life stops when respiration ceases." Yeah, this too, reflecting on something like that, reflecting on how our life completely depends on those inhalations and exhalations continuing. Our whole life is in that. Can you afford to wait for 100 years when you don't know how soon death will come? You may die after having eaten a good breakfast in the morning. You may die in the afternoon after a good lunch. Some die during sleep. You may die in the midst of going here and there. No one can determine the time of death. Therefore, you must awaken before you die. And then kind of out of nowhere, he says, look at the sea. Not only when there is wind do waves arise. Even when the sea is calm, waves are rising and falling thousands of times. One way to understand this is just that even without our perceiving it, we are subject to constant flux, that our lives are so often based on this assumption that things will go on, they'll stay the same, we'll continue living. But in fact, we're just riding this wave of change to where we don't know, for how long we don't know. A defiled person will call this world a sea of suffering. An awakened one will call it a Buddha world. At that time, the 10,000 things will be transformed into the 10,000 subtle functions. For an enlightened person, it is simply all illuminated. For a defiled person, it is simply all defiled. All is arising from your own mind. The Buddha world arises from your own mind. Its transformation into the sea of suffering likewise arises from your own mind. Assembly, reflect on this. I trust that your practice will progress during this winter retreat. Again, he brings us back to the premise of practice, that our experience of life is determined by the mind. It's all in the mind. And then this is the second lecture of this Discourses from a Winter Retreat. Since we have entered this meditation retreat, 2 weeks have gone by. Now only 75 days remain. It always draws a nervous chuckle. Only 75 days remain. The sufferings of transmigrating within the ocean of birth and death, as well as the happiness of the sublime Dharma Dhatu appearing brilliantly before your eyes, do not come from outside. They are also not given to us by anyone else. You do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. Neither does somebody else grant you happiness. They are created and experienced by yourself alone. You have to endure sufferings because you created them yourself. Likewise, you experience happiness because you have created it yourself. And this is the same theme, that we have the power through the mind to create our world to a large extent. This statement, you do not have to endure sufferings because someone else gave them to you. This is the absolute opposite of the victimology that is so common these days. This, of course, doesn't mean that others don't share responsibility for some of our suffering, and should be held accountable for that, of course. But we have a big hand in our experience of things. Two people who experience the same kind of, let's say, mistreatment can come out of it differently. And one big factor would be meditation as a way to not cling to the experience, the mistreatment, let's say. During the 24 hours of the day, in all of the four positions, that means standing, sitting, lying, and walking, when you are coming, the koan should be coming. When you are going, the koan should also be going. You should investigate earnestly, carefully, and in detail. This is something that can really enrich the practice of working on a koan, is to bring a meticulous attention to it. I always watch meditators when they are walking here and there. How many hold the koan firmly? Usually when they are coming and going or eating, they completely forget about the koan and just act blindly according to circumstances. With such practice, it is hard to say when such people will ever awaken. You must pay a great deal of attention to this. So again, the importance of making the practice continuous, carrying it outside the zendo, making the effort as difficult as it is. It can so much enrich our practice to really make every effort to keep it going, keeping the awareness going when we're moving about. And the conditions of sesshin are the best. This is our best shot. Keeping our eyes down, maintaining silence, this is where we have our best chance of keeping the awareness continuous. You should take great awakening as your aim and model and never let the mind be at ease. If you act without caring to raise the koan, mind and body will surely be at ease, but this is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. So sometimes people will object to, let's say, working on a koan because it creates a certain tension, anxiety. But that's the point. The point is to create this doubt sensation, to by setting up a practice where you... that is confounding a koan, by setting up a confounding question, it drives us deeper into the mind. Questioning is the best way to get inside anything. Even just in socially, to meet someone and ask questions is a way of getting closer to the person, understanding the person. And certainly it's true with a koan. And he's saying that, yes, a practice where there is no koan you're going to feel more at ease. It's going to be more relaxing. But this, he says, is just like water flowing away. Indeed, the lives of sentient beings flow away like this. Now, having taken up the practice of 10,000 actions, don't quite know what he means, You should endure what is difficult to endure and do what is difficult to do. This is known as austerity, for the very reason that it involves undergoing what is difficult. The Buddhas and the patriarchs did not realize Buddhahood easily. They realized it through great effort and much hardship. They exerted themselves with such great effort because the sufferings of birth and death are so terrifying. There's a Chinese proverb, all discipline begins with the fear of death. You can see this operating just in a very common way as we get older. A lot of people who were not particularly careful about exercise or diet will start to take it more seriously, those things. Therefore, he says, even though you want to sleep more, you should sleep less. Even though you want to eat more, you should eat less. Even though you want to talk a lot, you should try to talk less. Even though you want to see many things, you should see less. Well, like movies and other things, or idle travel. Your body will definitely feel restrained by acting in such a way. This is indeed a practice of austerity. However, none of the Buddhas and patriarchs would have awakened had they not trained themselves in this manner. So a great, great call for plain old self-discipline. He is talking to his monks, or at least those in training. But who would not benefit? Who among us would not benefit from leading more disciplined lives and doing less in the way of self-indulgence, more in the way of moderation? Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.